Daenerys welcomes him to the
right.
race.
Right. And so it's the, so whatever we normally suppose about like the big ticket candidate getting in at the end late or later than the other candidates, that didn't occur here. And yet it is, I think it is so much his race to lose simply because of the reaction that he creates out of the Republicans. Every action has an opposite and equal reaction. And Trump doesn't know how to handle Biden. I don't think he knows what to do with Sanders, but you and I've talked about it. We can't vote for a socialist. I don't think other people will be able to vote for a socialist. I think he dispatches almost everybody else. I don't think Beto or Mayor Pete have the gravitas to get up there yet.
I think, and I've been hearing more from some other people that Mayor Pete, so the more he's in the arena, the more he is not quite living up to the expectation of him.
Yeah, because, I mean,
he's a small mayor.
Yeah.
It's an exciting prospect, and I love that we have Mayor Pete running for president of the United States. I just don't think he beats Donald Trump.
I don't think Wayne Messam should be running for governor either, or for president either. I think you do need to have some. I'm not ready to hand over the foreign policy of this country over to the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. That doesn't mean I want Donald Trump to continue to handle it or not handle it, but I'm just not ready. I go with Biden.
Although all of us kind of debate back and forth, we are both of us as we're sitting, we're both registered Republicans talking about the Democratic field. And even though we're pretty progressive in a lot of stuff, maybe we should talk to a Democrat who's used to doing presidential campaigns in Florida.
Do you know one?
I do.
Do you? All right. So who?
I have my good friend Steve Shale.
Oh yeah, I know that guy.
Do you know him?
I read about him all the time in the New York Times.
Do you remember that draft Joe Biden campaign? He was the guy who started it.
Yeah, but he did all that on MSNBC, and he wouldn't wear pants, so I didn't trust him.
Well, no one knew that he wasn't wearing pants.
Yeah, but
they were watching
MSNBC.
Right? Only people who were on his Instagram knew it. It's amazing. So let's talk to Steve Shale about Joe Biden's exciting announcement for presidency of the United States and what he thinks a Biden campaign should look like.
Okay, we're here with Steve Shale, probably the most noteworthy Democratic consultant in Florida. He's a member of our Influence magazine, Influence 100. He's a lobbyist at the advocacy group, which is Al Cardenas' firm, our good friends, Slater Bayless, Steve Shiver, Sarah Buskey is at that firm. And so we wanted to have you on this morning to talk 2020 politics, because after Friday, it seems like that's what we'll all be shifting to, is the Democratic primary in terms of news coverage.
Well, good morning to y'all, and thanks for having me on. It's always good to talk to you guys.
Well, thanks for joining us. That was a great intro, Peter, but most importantly, Steve's a friend. I've gone to battle with Steve, and he's one of my favorite Democrats to work with. So it's nice to have you on, and we have been talking about Joe Biden off and on for years now. So I'm really excited to finally, you're not drafting Joe Biden. Joe Biden is running. How does that feel that this is a reality?
Well, you know, the funny thing, Michelle, in my career, the things that I've sort of wanted to have happen, dreams I've had, they always seem to happen a cycle after I thought they were going to. So this is, it's really neat. I mean, is you know, as we talked about a lot, I had a chance to get to know the vice president a little bit, in 2008 and 12, and came to really admire him, not only for his leadership, but, you know, for just the way that he treats people, interacts with people. I think that there is there's a style of politics that I think you guys know I have subscribed to, which is, you know, that, you know, world can get a lot done if people are willing to kind of just be decent to one another. And I think, I think we're at a time where we've had a chance to see what happens when we get away from that. And whether you support Trump or not, I think most people, I would hope, believe that the style of politics he brings is not necessarily healthy to the dialogue. And, you know, I'm excited that we've seen the kind of support since he got in that we have. And I think it's a there's a desire to move the country forward in a different kind of voice, and hopefully it'll continue.
Well, I have a little bit of bad news for you. I know I've always been telling you that Ella and I were ready to be Republicans for Biden.
Yep.
Well, we're going to be Democrats because we want to vote in this primary. So I am changing my party registration so I can vote for Joe. So I'm sorry that I can't be a Republican for Biden, but I think the vote's better.
We can't use Republicans for Biden until we get the Democrats for Biden. So I certainly appreciate that.
That's right. So I'll switch back then. I'll be a flip-flopper.
Steve, what is the what's your origin story with the vice president? I know that you probably are going to be talking about this stuff, but you know, you are you're Mr. Joe Biden in Florida. And so, you know, walk us through how that came to be. A lot of people who follow your career know that you had a big role in 2008 and 12 for President Obama, but how did you get to Vice President Biden?
Peter, I think as you know well enough about me, I'm not super strategic about anything that I do. I'm sort of one of those folks that feel like I've been very lucky that God's opened doors for me from time to time. And, it's interesting. I had really no sense of who Joe Biden was other than I heard him speak at a Jefferson Jackson dinner way back in the day. Until 2008, and sort of funny story. I think I may have told you to this anecdote one time. You know, during the 2008 presidential campaign, I lived with my sister in Tampa, and my beloved nephew Connor, who's probably the closest thing I have to my own child. Connor was 13, 14 years old, and Connor one morning decided he didn't really want to go to school. He kind of just wanted to come hang out, and so I said, well, you know, you're not going to get to hang out, Connor. You're going to get to go with me to staff Joe Biden today. And I'm sure that's probably the last thing that 13-year-old child wanted to do on a nice day when he could sit in and play with his Xbox is to go with his uncle to a political rally. And so, you know, I've got the kid with me, and we're wandering around sort of all the things you do before a rally. And, you know, we get the note, the motorcade's pulling up. And so I kind of go back in the back to introduce myself and sort of point him in the direction of the whatever thing we were doing first. And I've got my little nephew there. And the vice president, or then Senator Biden, walked in, and he walked immediately past me. He walked past all the donors that were back there, all the political electeds, and he immediately got on the ground, put my nephew in a headlock, and said, "Come on, man, why aren't you at school today?" And really like spent a few minutes with him talking about why he was there. And you know, I think for me, that moment sort of like, you know, it was, it, you know, chances to see that, you know, I mean, he really is a real human being. And, you know, and then the more time I had a chance to spend with him, the more time I had a chance to sort of learn his story and see the role he played in the administration, but also see how he, you know, he interacted when I had a chance to staff him here with people. And I became a believer. And so, you know, as you probably remember in 2015, I sort of stumbled into playing the role of advocating for him to run. You know, honestly, I think a lot of us after he decided not to run in 2015, thought that was the end of the story. And then Trump got elected and Charlottesville happened. And I think all the same reasons why I wanted to see him run in 2015 were the same in 2019, and I'm excited that we're going to do it.
I saw the Morning Consult poll that came out today. We're taping on Tuesday, so people hear this tomorrow or Thursday, that he did have a good bump, that Mayor Pete seems to maybe not be taking off, but he is 8 or 9 points ahead of Bernie Sanders. And I guess is that where you would have expected him to be? Are you worried about, or is not... And when I say you, I mean the campaign in a lot of ways. I know you're not speaking for it, but in terms of the Biden, Team Biden, you know, what's your thought in running in this kind of, I don't know, multi-way field where 25%, 20% may mean victory?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think in some ways, again, this is just my opinion of the world. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, while it is the largest field we've ever had, you know, at the same time, I think the basic rules of running for president apply. You know, the race is going to narrow down in the first few states, and then, you know, the candidate's able to sort of build a coalition going forward. You know, past Iowa, New Hampshire, assuming they get through Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, can raise money and build off momentum is going to be the nominee. So I don't know that the trajectory of the fight is going to be different, even if it means we're going to have debates on two stages. But I think also the polls are going to go up and down. I mean, certain economic can't live and die on polling. I think the one sort of, you know, theory of the case I've had, and I'm certainly not alone in this view, is, listen, I mean, if you talk to, and you guys do this, you know, when you don't live in Washington and you don't live in MSNBC and CNN green rooms, and you talk to real people, you realize there's a lot of affinity out there for Joe Biden. And a lot of people wanted to see him run. And I think it tends to get that piece gets lost if you get all of your news off of Twitter. So I'm not surprised that we saw, you know, not only a little bit of bump in the polls, and listen, I expect those numbers move around, but I think even more meaningful to me is the fact that on day one had 100,000 donors. 65% of those donors were people that we didn't have on any email list anywhere. These are just organic people that came to the website and gave money. I mean, politics has been unpredictable in these days. I'm not going to get ahead of it, but our job is to continue to build support and give people who want to get involved a route to feel like they're engaged in the campaign and go take the fight to the early states and see what happens.
So how do we make sure that Joe Biden doesn't turn into the Jeb Bush of this presidential election cycle? I mean, Jeb Bush was easily the favorite. You know, he had the traditional money behind him. Everyone thought that he was going to be a lock to be our nominee. And one could say that Joe Biden could be the favorite and everyone can kind of see his path. How do we make sure that what happened to Jeb doesn't happen to him? We don't want people to discard Joe Biden just because he is from a prior administration and maybe we're looking for something new, or, you know, how do we keep the excitement about him and how we keep people from getting complacent?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, every election cycle is different. And, you know, I think that one of the challenges that, you saw this in some ways, I think that the 2016 Republican nomination was a lot more like the 2008 Democratic nomination than anything else, in that you had a party that had lost two presidential election cycles in a row to a guy they couldn't figure out how they lost to. I mean, Democrats could never get their arms around how they lost to George Bush. And Republicans, God bless my Republican friends, never understood how they could lose to Barack Obama twice. And, you know, and just like the Democrats had nominated sort of, you know, the somewhat accepted sort of nominee both times in 2004, Republicans had nominated, you know, sort of McCain-Romney style person. And I think just as if I was always of the theory, I think we probably talked about this 10 years ago, that in 2008, the Democrats were going to nominate somebody different than Clinton just because there was a hunger for something different. And in the same way that you saw Republicans, when push came to shove, I just never believed, as much as I have a lot of friends in Jeb world, that Republicans were going to nominate another person that kind of fit the same bill as the two guys that lost. I think the difference this time is functionally, first of all, I think Democratic voters have a much deeper relationship with Joe Biden than Republicans had with Jeb Bush. You know, they've seen him on the national stage. He's been a fixture in politics for you know, as long as I've been alive. But most importantly, they saw him as vice president for 8 years. They lived the ups and downs with him. You know, it's interesting. I've said this before, like when you staff Joe Biden, and it's unlike anything any other political person I've been around, except at some levels, I mean, I don't want to say Chris, that's unfair, but like, you know, you remember when you would with staff Chris, people would come up to him and they would treat him like he was a member of the family.
Yes.
And it was very sort of different than if you're around, you know, Governor Scott or Alex Sink or really anybody else. I mean, there was a different level of thing. I mean, people are the same way around the vice president. And there's that relationship, which is just, it's just a different kind of relationship. And I think that's why, and again, I don't want to get too hung up on polling, because it's still early and these numbers are going to move. But, I think the reason why, I mean, there were a lot of people in punditry world that thought that as people got into the race, Joe Biden's numbers would go down. And it didn't happen. And so, I think that goes to I think that there is a different kind of relationship with him. And I also think that, you know, listen, I think that, you know, Democrats are hungry to beat Donald Trump.
Yeah, I was going to say this election is not.
Republicans with the sane mind are also hungry for Donald Trump to be beaten. Thank you.
It's just not in this election's not happening in a vacuum. I mean, this if it were, I don't think Biden even runs in a way if it's the third term of or, you know, if it's the end of Jeb Bush's presidency, then I think you have, you know, this wide open Democratic field. But what Democrats are looking for is, and there are going to be so many Game of Thrones metaphors on this particular podcast because of the big episode on Sunday, but they're looking for a champion, you know, to fight for them against this, you know, Clegane kind of character who is just this monster in their eyes. And yes, they really like Amy Klobuchar, and they really like Kamala Harris even. But is that the person that can go toe to toe with Trump? And I think what we saw this right out of the gate this weekend was it's not only is Biden going to bring it to Trump. There's no doubt about that. Biden is going to get Trump to swing at the pitches. And I think that that's the key, is that he will, you know, if this is a debate about whether or not Charlottesville and the president's reaction to it was appropriate, then I do think Joe Biden ends up winning the election. If Trump is smart, he just keeps talking about stock numbers and the economy, and he avoids this stuff. But that's just not in his DNA. He is going to tweet at Sleepy Joe and fight with him. And I think Joe Biden, you know, like Joe said, or the vice president said a couple of years ago, you know, what was it that he would take him out in the back and, you know, kick the shit out of him or something like that. There was some sort of,
not exact quote, but yeah, I think it was roughly that. What's funny about the Sleepy Joe thing, I said this on Twitter in response to a reporter the other day. And so I, you know, when the boss was in Florida back in October, I staffed him for a couple of days, and we did that rally with Nelson and Gillum in Tampa, flew to Jacksonville, just did a couple of things up there. Long story short, like, we finally got back to the hotel about 10 o'clock because the one thing that is certain is that in most things, Joe Biden is going to be the last person to leave because people want to talk to him. He's going to stick around and talk to folks. That's his nature. So about 10 o'clock at night, we get back to the hotel. And I mean, boss is like ready to go. it's been up since 5 a.m. and he's ready to go. And I'm calling my wife going, I can't do this. I'm too old for this. I need to go to bed. He's got an energy level like I wouldn't believe. So it's a nickname. I'm not sure where that one came from.
What's he like? You know, I mean, this is the best part of you is, you know, I think I think Charlie Crist doesn't get the credit he deserves on a personal level. I know everybody treats him as a rock star, outside of it when he was governor, but there just seems like there's a similarity there. I mean, you hinted at it before, but there just seems like there is
like every person has worth to Joe Biden. Like, he makes everyone right. Isn't that what it seems like when he comes into a room? Just like Charlie, he cares about the line cook preparing the food for the banquet with the,
is that just middle $1,000 donors Pennsylvania upbringing? I mean he was raised in Delaware, but still.
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, I don't know, I'm certainly not a expert on it. I mean, I think that, I mean, listen, I mean, Kristen Biden and a lot of those are very different people, but I do think that sense of, you know, every person there is important. Every person there has a story. Every person in there has essentially a challenge they're going through. And, you know, and I think, I'm sure part of it is, you know, nature of family. He grew up in a family where, I mean, if you, for example, read the book he wrote, you know, after Beau died, he talks a lot about how important family is. And I think he is a sense of humanity about him, which is, and I don't want to be unfair to other politicians, but it's just, you know, that's, he views his role, my sense is someone who, you know, can put a human face on what politics means and understands that politicians can make a meaningful difference, not only on policy, but in people's lives. But the other thing about him, which is, you know, which I sort of like, and you know, this isn't the case with everybody. You guys have covered enough politicians, but he's exactly the same person in front of the camera as behind the camera. I mean, there's not a different face. You know, I think that's, you know.
So then what are the warts there then? I mean, is it, you know, what's the.
Oh, I'll leave that to other people to pick on. You know, but I do think that part of why you see high favorables, and I think part of why you see people really, you know, get excited about him running is we're in an era of politics where authenticity really matters. And, you know, you saw it with someone with Trump. I mean, you know, I find Trump abhorrent in the way he handles the, you know, the way he deals with people and the way that we're viewed around the world and the fact that we've abandoned some basic values I think are pretty important to us as a country. You know, but he is anything if not authentic. You know, I mean, he sort of speaks his mind. And, you know, and I think that in a lot of ways that was Obama's strength and that he was, you know, he was able to kind of break through the clutter because he was kind of a regular guy. You know, and I think, you know, Joe Biden, he couldn't be inauthentic if he wanted to be. It's just not who he is. And so, but yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, again, these things are, you know, they're long journeys and, you know, it was a long ways to go, but I think the rollout went well and, you know, see where it goes from here.
So I've been pretty honest that part of the reason why I am supporting Joe Biden is because there's a lot of me that longs for the time before Donald Trump was president of the United States. I long for the decency before he became our commander in chief. And Joe Biden is so tied up to that time because he was the vice president. And it was a more hopeful time. But that's not enough of a reason for everybody to vote for him. So what does Joe Biden stand for? Like, if you were giving someone an elevator pitch, like, this is why you should vote for Joe Biden, what would you say?
Well, I mean, listen, I think you're going to see him roll out over the next few weeks, you know, more significant sort of policy views on things. And he's, you know, we got yesterday, and you know, if you watch his speech in Pittsburgh or on Monday, I know it's recording on Tuesday. You know, he began to lay out a real vision of rebuilding a middle class, rebuilding an economy which works for the middle class in a different kind of way, the backbone of America, as he talked about it yesterday, and whether that's raising the minimum wage, whether that's reforming the corporate tax code in a way that provides more tax relief and more investments for people down the ballot, I mean, down the income stream, providing options on healthcare, such as, you know, people buying Medicare or other types of public options. I think, again, you began to sort of see a little bit of that yesterday, and I think over the next few weeks, you'll see him lean in more on some of those ideas, and we'll go from there. But I also, I mean, you know, one of the things that, you know, as I remember a reporter in 2016, after Joe Biden gave his speech at the DNC, Democratic National Convention, he talked about, you know, sort of like, you know, the best Joe Biden is the Joe Biden that talks about what America can be. And, you know, he believes at his core, as he says in every single speech, quite literally, he believes that America's greatest days are ahead. He believes that America is better positioned in the world than we've ever been, because in a new world economy that is built on your ability to innovate and your ability to be productive, no one does that better in America. And we can't be afraid to lean into that. So, again, I'm not going to get ahead of him on some of the policy stuff. I'll let him talk about that. But I think you'll see a very forward-leaning, a very forward-leaning agenda. But one that is rooted in this basic value that every American has a shot.
I want to talk a little bit about something you don't talk a lot enough about, and that's you. I think you're always out there kind of advocating for someone else. I mean, if we're talking to Steve Shale from 10 years ago, it's for the president. If it's from, you know, 6 years ago, it's for Charlie Crist or what have you. And so let's talk to me or talk to us about, I think it's an interesting position right now. You're wrapping up the legislative session. You've got to do all this client servicing here, and you've got some big ticket clients. How do you balance it all right now as you're making this transition, or there's this period of transition where you're having to juggle the needs of a national campaign against, hey, I got to put bread on the table, and so I got to deal with, you know, House Committee X on this small bill that I've been working on for 6 months?
Well, fortunately, I have ADD, so it's good. I'm able to kind of bounce around pretty well, and probably haven't mowed the lawn recently enough. But yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's, you know, anybody who's done this long enough realizes you have to kind of be able to multitask. But, you know, it's interesting to me about session is, you know, my view of stress around session changed dramatically after I had the opportunity and the honor to work for President Obama. You know, after managing, you know, basically a 600 employee operation, you know, with the kind of budget we had and the kind of operation we had, you know, and the stress of that and sleeping 2 hours a night for 2 months and that kind of stuff. You know, I think it provided a good perspective on sort of learning to understand what's important and what's not important. And so, you know, I mean, I've as you know, Peter, I've never sort of had my foot fully in one world or the other. I've always sort of had a foot in the legislature, even when I was doing politics more regularly. And, you just sort of have to compartmentalize and get through it. The good news is that it ends on Friday. The founding fathers of Florida got a lot of things wrong, but one thing they got right, which is a maximum 60-day legislative session. So fortunately, that's the case. And next year, it'll be over even earlier.
Are you going to be taking on some other political campaigns or anything like that? Or is that kind of tabled for right now? Or are you going to dabble back in that?
I really don't know. I mean, I've taken on a couple of newer projects over the last few years. I'm involved in an interesting little project over in Pensacola, which we actually last year changed the way that they appoint their school superintendent, and which was a fun little thing to work on. And you know, I mean, again, I in part I got out of politics because I spent, you know, between 2002 and 2012, I think I spent as many nights on the road as I spent at home. I have the dubious distinction of saying I've driven four cars in my adult life. Over 200,000 miles, which is not something I think I really wear as a badge of honor these days. You know, and so, I mean, getting out of politics as a full-time vocation was as much about just kind of getting my life in order and having a chance to do some of the stuff I've done internationally over the last 5 or 6 years that I couldn't have done if I'd stayed kind of both feet in politics. You know, and again, I mean, I think it's well known. I'm not the world's greatest business person, and I'm okay with that, you know. For me, it's more about working to live. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, again, I like projects that provide intellectual challenge and make me use my brain in a different sort of way. So, I don't know that I'm ever going to get back in the world of you know, trying to run 10 legislative campaigns. But I mean, if there's a political project or two that looks interesting, I'll be there.
So I have never partaken in it, and so I need you to explain to our listeners. What the hell is the Busy Bee Caucus, of which I believe you are a
isn't founding, he the founding member? Is he the chairman of the board?
Yeah, I think actually maybe I think Wayne Birch actually runs the Busy Bee Caucus. So, you know, the Busy Bee, which is folks who listen to this, I imagine most people know, is a truck stop in Live Oak, Florida. And Live Oak is a perfect exact 1 hour, 10 minute from my house, either driving to Tampa, which is what I feel like I do every day, or driving back. And so it's a great place to, in early in the morning, to stop and get a cup of coffee, or, you know, on the way back, maybe use the restroom, get gas kind of thing. And for people that have made that trip, as much as I have, and I would probably argue, I think I probably rank up there over the last 20 years, having driven that as much as any human being in the state who doesn't drive professionally. You know, it, we used to, there was a McDonald's and a Exxon's Chevron station and a Shell station on one side of the road and sort of nothing on the other. And about 4 or 5 years ago, during the 2014 election, there was a new truck stop that got built on the north side of the road where there used to be a Penn Oil gas station called the Busy Bee. And you could sort of see it going up. It was an interesting thing. And so I was actually driving back. It was around, I think, one of the 2014 debates, actually. I stopped late at night to get gas, and I just sort of drove over to that side of the road to see if the gas station was done yet or not. And sure enough, it was open. And so I went in and got gas and walked in. And what was interesting is that the guy behind the counter, who I've often described to people, Peter, it could have been you or me, sort of a, you know, late 30s, early 40s guy, you know, pretty well-dressed guy. You know, I said, tell me about this place. And he's like, you know, the owner's from Madison, yada, yada, yada. He goes, but you don't know how important this is to my community. I've been out of work for 18 months. This is the first major economic, this is the first big thing to happen to our economy and our community in as long as I can remember. And sort of like at that moment, it kind of like hit me, like this place has to make it. And this place really can be something that, I mean, it's, you know, like nobody should build their economy around a truck stop, but like, you know, if that's all you got, that's not unimportant. And so I kind of started out a little bit as a I don't want to say it was a joke, it's sort of unfair to that, but like I was just trying to get people to kind of go there because, you know, for the 100 or so people that work there, a lot of them hadn't had a job in years. Because we forget, as well as the economy has been doing over the last 8 or 10 years in places like you and I live in, there's huge swaths of this state where the economy has left them behind. And one of those places is Columbia County. So that's kind of how, that's kind of the origin story of that. It was just really, I thought it was a neat story of a Florida-owned business that was creating jobs in a community that was really struggling. And I thought I could sort of do my part to kind of raise some attention onto it, and ended up being much bigger than at least in the political realm. But the other thing that's sort of fun about it is, and I think, you know, you're in the same boat, is I do think it's important for us to find things that bring Republicans and Democrats together, and get people that don't normally talk to each other to talk to each other. And again, it's sort of in some ways dumb as it sounds, like, you know, like there's a little sort of cult following around the Busy Bee, which again, I mean, is sort of united some folks in politics and gives people something to talk about. And that's always a good thing. I mean, we as long as we all create space to talk to each other, we can still do big things.
I will say I do feel kind of blessed. I don't know. Sometimes I feel like Isaac on the Love Boat, kind of like the entertainment, or he's the bartender, but, you know, somewhat of the entertainment director sometimes to the process, where, you know, we'll roll out Tally Madness, or we'll roll out just like apolitical tweet threads that do get people from both sides engaged. And that's when I'm happiest in the process. You know, you bring up, I know you're a road warrior, the whole world does, but what's your favorite place in Florida? I think I know the answer. It may be your hometown, but you see a lot of places, probably, like you say, I think you have to get outside of off of 75 and 95, and you start seeing some really interesting places in Florida. So, you know, what's your favorite place in Florida?
Yeah, I mean, so for me, like, you know, as I get older, the things about the state that interest me are as much the people that you meet as they are the places. You know, I think I've told you, I've been thinking about writing a book about the state for a while. And, you know, so I now sort of find myself just trying to find people that have interesting stories when I travel. But, you know, I mean, I think what's fascinating, and I think, again, I think what drives the state's politics is the fact that we are this interesting place that tends to take on the values and politics of where people come from, which is why, you know, like if you, I would sort of joke, like if you're a new reporter coming to cover like the Tampa Bay area, you know, go to a Bears Bucks game and tell me who the home team is. And that's why the politics there is very Midwestern. You know, and so I think that's sort of where I start. But in terms of just like the state itself, I mean, you know, I'm a St. Augustine boy. I think it's just this neat marriage of sort of old Florida and new Florida. You know, it's where I grew up, and I love Northeast Florida in general. And, you know, it's, you know, one of these days, hopefully I can go back. You know, and I think there's some really beautiful places in the state. I love that drive sort of through sort of the heart of agricultural land, sort of south of Orlando, where it almost gets sort of eerie at times. It doesn't look, it looks almost otherworldly, but I think it's beautiful. You know, you know, when you fly in, if you fly in or out of Fort Lauderdale, Miami at the right time, and you hit the Everglades kind of right around golden hour, you know, again, just some of the most beautiful places you'll ever see. I think you know, there's a reason why I've never moved to Washington or any place else. I love this place, and I think we're all blessed to live here. What did Chris say about him? What did Chris say about Florida? Like, she's a
with the prettiest
girl.
Name.
Exactly. You know, and
I mean, Peter, you know, come on, you've heard that how many times? Florida, yeah, the state with the prettiest name.
Listen, I love Charlie to death. I am trying to block parts of 2014 out of my memory.
Of course, yes, because there are some things that you just need to forget.
And some people. I'm not bringing it up, but I'm thinking of somebody.
I will say that I ran into Charlie in D.C. about 6 months ago, he looks like he's really enjoying being in Congress, and I'm super happy for him. And as a result, I'm super happy for the Bay Area. They've got, you know, he seems to be absolutely taking to that process in a way that
Michelle wants to ask you a question about locations, but I want to ask you about that. Is there a leadership? I mean, you know, DC a little bit better. Is there a leadership shot for him? I don't think he has enough time to become speaker, but all right, so, you know, let's say Pelosi, Hoyer, et cetera, you know, step down in 2 to 4. another wave moves up there. There isn't a Joe Crowley up there. I really think Charlie, when I think Charlie could be the next Joe Crowley, where he's, you know, number four or five in charge, or he is chair of ways and means or something like that. I imagine he's, you know, still very good at raising money for people. He's got a pretty big network. And I keep telling people, hey, I don't know if he's going to run against Scott or run against Rubio if the seat were to open or something like that. But I really could see Charlie Crist fulfilling the destiny. I think there'd be an irony here. I could see him becoming our next Bill Young, our most powerful guy that we've had up there since Young had passed away. And after he was able to bring basically a Super Bowl home, I mean, every year. Am I crazy for thinking that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where he fits in that going forward. And that's not a slight on him. I just honestly don't know. I mean, I think the two things where Chris could, I think, really, you know, excel is, I mean, first of all, I think he'd be a pretty darn good, like DCCC chair, you know, in that, again, he's very good at raising money. He's, you know, he's very good at sort of understanding the types of candidates you have to recruit to win in places. I mean, he's, you know, I think he's, you know, I think he would be, I'd love to see him sort of take on that kind of role. And I think that'd be the kind of role that could thrust him into something different. The other thing is, like, I think just as he's there, you know, one of the things that I always appreciated about him, even when he was a Republican, is he's a guy that understands that the more people you bring to a coalition, the better chance you have to get things done. And, you know, and he doesn't take, you know, politics personally, which is remarkable given the amount of crap he's taken incoming in his life. You know, and Washington's still a place where relationships matter. And I think as he gains seniority, even if he doesn't sort of end up in a true leadership role per se, you know, he will over time become leaders on the committees he serves and take on bigger and bigger issues he's involved with. And again, his ability to work across the aisle to build relationships, you know, I think he's very well suited for that place. And I hope he stays there for a while, frankly, for not just for him, but for the region.
You know, I agree with you. I think he's in the place where he should be. And it is good for St. Petersburg and Tampa Bay to have Charlie serving in Congress. And I definitely think he should stay there. We share your love of St. Augustine, but, you know, we don't know as much about it because we're not from there like you are. What are your three favorite places in St. Augustine? Because I'm always looking for
new things to our list. But so I want to hear him talk about it.
So what are your three favorite places in St. Augustine? Because that's a city that's important to us. That's where I like to say Peter and I actually fell in love with St. Augustine. So we make it a regular stop on our yearly travels.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, there's the St. Augustine I grew up in, which is a little bit different than the St. Augustine now. I mean, there's so many new restaurants that have opened over the last 10 or 15. I mean, I haven't lived there since 2003. I get back quite a bit. My family still we still own a marina there. So I get back quite a bit to help with the family stuff. But like, again, it's not home per se, but I mean, I think that being said, I mean, I really, in terms of restaurants, my favorite restaurant in town is Gypsy Cab Company, which is over on Anastasia Boulevard.
The best.
Buy that salad. We take a cooler with us to St. Augustine every time. So we can buy that salad dressing to bring it home.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was funny. My mom, when she was a kindergarten teacher, one year she had a student who was from Gypsy Cab, and whose dad worked at Gypsy Cab. And when they would do the bring a snack day to school, the student would always bring in like a pound of carrots and like a gallon of dressing. And of course, you know, kindergartners, the last thing they want to eat is carrots and dressing. So that would end up at our house, which was always quite nice. You know, and I think, Peter, you can relate to this. We talked about our dads before, you know. I think part of Gypsy Cab for me is, you know, my dad also died young, and the place that he and I had our most meaningful conversations when I was an adult was there. We'd meet there for dinner. So, you know, so it's not only good food, but I think there's sort of an emotional sort of connection there. You know, down on the beach, there's a little kind of dive on A Street called Beachcomber, which again is sort of a little, you know, kind of hamburger hot dog kind of place right on the beach. You know, if you wear shoes in, they'll look at you funny. Kind of place. You know, I spent a lot of time there as a kid. I'd ride my bike down with friends and, you know, and eat there probably second. You know, I think sort of third, like I'm not even sure. I mean, there's some great restaurants, whether Collage or whether saying Casa Monica or Ice Plant now at where the distillery is, or Bog Brewing over on the west side. You know, I still love just walking around town. I mean, I just think it's there's so much interesting history there, not just the history of the place that goes back 450 years, but even the history of the place that goes back only 50 years. I grew up in that town at a time when there were still heroes and villains from the civil rights movement that you knew personally. I like the whole vibe of the place. I like it's a little sort of culturally, it's a little bit different. It's a little bohemian at times, which is kind of fun. I just think it's a great little cool little place. I worry about it. I wish I could figure out how to get some of the cars out of downtown. I think that's the only thing I hate when I go back now. It's just hard to get around. But
yeah, it is getting more congested. I will say, on one of our last trips we did, we just literally stumbled upon the Civil Rights Freedom Trail in St. Augustine. And I was amazed at how many times we've been there and the history that I wasn't aware of. So we did take some time to take Ella down through a few stops. We found our way there because we ended up at a good little brunch spot, and it happened to be in that part of town.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. I went to church at a place called Trinity. It's also where I got married, yeah, which is a little Episcopalian church right next to Casa Monica. So I think it's the oldest Protestant church in America. But when I was a kid, there was actually the guy that was our veterinarian when I was a kid, his dad had been the preacher there for years, Charlie Seymour. And I always knew Charlie as a sort of really neat, older, retired preacher. And he had, what I didn't know until I was in college was, Charlie Seymour had integrated Trinity Church, during the sort of MLK days in the mid 60s when MLK was in the city. A group of black leaders came and said, we want to come to church with you on Sunday. And they said, absolutely, let's do it. And Charlie said, sure, it's God's house. Of course you can come to church. And did not realize that the vestry was going to go crazy. And a bunch of guys in the vestry tried to chain the doors to the church closed to keep people out. They eventually essentially ran Reverend Seymour out of town, ostensibly kind of a gunpoint kind of thing. He moved to New Orleans, was a pastor there for years, came back to St. Augustine. What was interesting, you talk about the sort of the life of a place. When I left town, Charlie Seymour helped oversee the process to bring in the church's first African-American rector. There's sort of stories like that all throughout town of these little heroes. Even my old boss, Doug Wiles, his dad, Herbie Wiles, was one of the first guys in town to sell insurance to both blacks and whites. And it's really neat when you kind of get in there and realize, and certainly our mutual friend, Kevin Sweeney, has even more stories than I do.
It was awesome going over there with Sweeney. The last time we were there, or the second to last time.
Yeah.
He's as proud of St. Augustine as we are of St. Petersburg. And so he introduced us to the president of Flagler, I think. And
the president wasn't there, but they did. They arranged.
They took us up onto the roof.
He and Beth gave the VIP, Ella and I VIP a very tour. Special behind the scenes tour, and had a book from the president that still sits out on our coffee table.
Right.
Well, when we have one. I don't have one at the moment.
It seems like, and Steve, you tell me if I'm wrong, is St. Augustine, and it's kind of, although they're two totally different cities, I think they're very similar in that they've had these renaissances, St. Pete and St. Augustine. It seems like St. Augustine is much busier now. And I know that like St. John's is dealing with all sorts of growth issues, but it just seems like, I know Florida is this huge tourist place, but it's like, did some people just after 500 years just discover St. Augustine again for the first time or something like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, when we moved, I was born in a little town called Kankakee in Illinois, about an hour south of Chicago. And we moved to Florida when I was 10, in part because my father had just had enough of the cold. My dad had been a North Dakota farm boy. And then grew up in the Midwest, and just I think at 45 said I'm tired of being cold, and so we moved to Florida. And it's interesting. I don't know if you've been to where Kevin and Beth live, but I grew up pretty close to their house, kind of off 16th Street in St. Augustine Beach, which in those days was still a dirt road. people thought we lived like on the moon compared to St. Augustine. Like it was, I mean, our little place in northern St. Augustine Beach, I mean, it was so far away. Like, why are you living all the way out there? You know, and, which is just kind of crazy. But I mean, when I moved there, the town had 12,000 people. St. Augustine Beach itself, the town had 2,000 people. You know, and it really has exploded. But, you know, tourism has always been the lifeblood of that place. I mean, when I was a kid, we had about 1 million to 2 million tourists a year. Today, it's about 6 or 7 million. You know, it's a double-edged sword because, you know, without tourism, the place would not be what it is today. The flip side is when people come there, they want to stay. And I don't necessarily think that the county has always done a great job of managing that well. I think when Cindy Stevenson's up here in the legislature now, I think it was somebody who tried really hard over the years. I've known her since she was a commissioner to try to help bring some more sanity to that process. And, you know, I do worry about it because the charm of the place is what draws people to it. And I know Kevin worries about this too. And if you lose that charm, you kind of lose what makes the city what it is. So, but you know, it's like every place. It's always going to be home for me. So it's always going to have a special place in my heart.
All right, we are going to let you get back to whatever you got to do in the last 72 hours. But what's your schedule like the next month? Where is the trail going to take you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know I got to get through Friday and probably next week. You know, mow my yard and do my laundry and figure out kind of what's next. And we'll see after that. I honestly don't know yet what we're going to do. I know wife and I are actually hoping to take a little vacation at some point. I may even have a little bit of international travel. I have that long promised trip to Pakistan, which you wrote about one time, which I may try to do this summer, actually. So we'll see. I mean, while the campaign is in full speed, it's also not immediately upon us. So, just going to try to get a little bit more life in before I lose my life completely.
That sounds like a good plan, and you definitely should make that happen.
No Disney cruise for you, though.
You know, I've never actually done a Disney cruise. I've actually only done one cruise. We did Alaska about 10 years. We did Alaska actually right after the 08 election, which, by the way, your kid's getting about big enough that would be a pretty cool trip for you guys.
We'll be adding it to the list. She has to get a little bit older, and we're going to do it.
Yeah, it's really cool. And when y'all get around to doing it, I mean, I'm certainly happy to talk about how we did it. But it's Alaska is there are two places I've been in the world where I realize just how insignificant we all are. One of them is Alaska, because when you realize when you're like literally 25 yards off the road, you're just in the food chain. It's not you could disappear. Nobody would ever know. You know, the place I walked a church one morning in Botswana, and I took a trail through the bush, and sort of the other place where I realized, like, oh my God, I am just a member of the food chain now. But no, it's an amazing place to go see.
Well, we appreciate you taking time out of your schedule, especially since it's such a busy week. And, we look forward to watching what you and Team Biden do. And,
yeah.
And we will, hopefully talk to you again a little bit later down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate y'all having it. And just generally kind of wishing y'all the best on the podcast and looking forward to getting caught up on some episodes when session's over.
All right. Thanks,
Steve. Sounds good. Thank you, Steve.
All right. Y'all take care.
You too. Bye.
I love talking to Steve because I will always give him credit if for nothing else, the Gypsy Cab recommendation in St. Augustine, which
that
you
was
know,
a great recommendation. That's a never miss for us. Anytime we go to St. Augustine, we have to go to Gypsy Cab Cafe. And I would have never found it on my own because I wouldn't have gotten in my car and driven across the Bridge of Lions to go find a restaurant when I was staying at the Casa Monica.
So what name did you hear come up again and again? And I know we asked about it a little bit. Well, what name did you hear come up again and again during that interview?
Well, Charlie Crist. And that's how Steve and I know each other. We've worked on Crist stuff together.
You know, I know you know what today is or what
yesterday.
As we're recording. It was, what was the anniversary?
The 9-year anniversary of Charlie's announcement out in Straub Park that he was leaving the Republican Party and running as an independent for the United States Senate.
All right. So I think there was a phase where Charlie was despised by Republicans, et cetera, through 2014. I think there is certainly a phase. I don't know if there is a Florida politician that is on his way to creating a full second act like Charlie did or Charlie has. You know, he could be in Congress pretty much for as long as he wants to at this point. He seems to be enjoying the job. But I don't think people realize what it looked like 9 years ago. And I know you do because you were, and the reason why I am married to you is because you were, your loyalty was described so effusively that it turned me on to you. Like, I was just like, I want to be with somebody that loyal.
I think there were only three of us left standing when this happened.
And that, who were the other two?
I'm not going to talk about.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about the other staffers.
Oh, wow. I didn't. Will you tell me afterwards?
We discussed it in the car on the way over here.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay.
Yes. Some people have gone on to establish Republican careers. Right. So we just, so 9 years ago today, I woke up to like the reality of, oh my gosh, we are running for the United States Senate without a party. And that is a different beast entirely.
But people want, there's this bullshit that people want. We want an independent to come out. We want a third party.
Oh my God, it's such bullshit. And let me tell you how much bullshit it is. We went to New York on this campaign and we were meeting with the No Labels organization. And these were very, very wealthy people who really wanted to see an independent. They wanted the end to the two-party system. It was of the utmost importance to them. And these people, like, had identified. I mean, Charlie was a very, very popular Republican governor, and he has a strong fundraising base. I mean, he's still a prolific fundraiser. His name ID was through the roof. If anyone was going to be able to pull off running as an independent, Charlie Crist should have been able to do it. Well, and these No Labels people should have definitely been able to, willing to put their money where their mouth was. To be very clear, they didn't put their money where their mouth was. I think they like donated a quarter of what they said that they were going to raise when we made that trip up to New York. So I always laugh
if there's
people.
One lesson, I think, from that, there's a lot of lessons from that, but you know, the idea of an independent, there's no such thing as a broke independent winning one of these races.
It's never going to happen.
The only way is if
you can self-fund.
If it's a billionaire independent. And then the key part to that is the billionaire part. It's not the independent part.
Like, right.
Howard Schultz is an independent. No, he's a billionaire. And that's why he's able to get away with whatever he's going to get away with, or Bloomberg is going to, what, even though he didn't decide to run.
I don't think people realize how difficult it is to run without a party. So 9 years ago today, I woke up to the news that our website was going to be disabled in 24 hours if we didn't find a new hosting service, that we were being fired because we were no longer a Republican. We woke up to the news that we were being fired by the company that did all of our promotional material printing. They printed the bumper stickers, the t-shirts, the yard signs, our logos.
Well, and Charlie loves bumper stickers.
Charlie loves them, and he's very specific about which ones he wants. You know, our logo, some of the Republican staffers who had left the campaign very kindly wiped their computers of stuff like the logo. So when we tried to go get a copy of the logo from the firm that we bought the logo, that designed the logo for us, they would not provide it for us because they were Republicans and we no longer were. So we had to get the logo redesigned. You know, we had to all of a sudden figure out how we were doing healthcare for the staff on the campaign because there wasn't a party to run that through anymore. We were now having to find office space. We had an office in Tallahassee that we did not lose, but you couldn't use party headquarters anymore either to be operating a campaign out of, because you had no party anymore.
And yet Charlie at one point was at 42.
He was at 42%.
And do you remember what happened that day?
You sent me flowers.
I did. What a good person.
You actually routinely sent me flowers during the campaign. I was
courting you.
I would be in the back room of our campaign headquarters with Margaret and she and I, Charlie's sister Margaret, and she and I would be looking at the budget and talking about who we needed to hire, where we needed to spend money. And in would walk some intern with, Michelle, there's a flower delivery for you. And there would be flowers from you, honey.
And that's why, you know.
That's how we got to where we are.
That's why we were on a Disney cruise this weekend. All right. So number one takeaway from And we should do, like, we should do a Chris retrospective.
Yeah, we'll have to do a deep dive one day. And maybe even then I'll finally give in and let him come on the pod, like, and finally give in to you and ask him to be on the podcast. No, I just don't want to go there.
Because if you're going to ask tough questions, but I don't know that you...
I don't have any tough... I mean...
You don't have the tough questions for the...
He and I are in a different place.
Right. Well...
You know, when you go through a battle... I will say this. When you go through
Dean
a battle...
tough questions.
No, you don't. You tease Dean. When you go through battles... I mean, we were exhausted traveling the state. It really was a family. Like, everybody talks about their campaign family, but when you're running a statewide campaign with, I think, 9 staffers, it's an actual family. Like, you're in it, and you feel every negative hit.
All those people who I know, and I don't want to ruin their lives by bringing them up now, you're still close to... I think
most of them.
Yeah. And you still had contact with all
of
them.
If any of them called me and asked me for a favor, I would do it in a heartbeat for them.
Yeah.
I mean, the band of others, as we were dubbed by a newspaper article, is definitely what we were. And I'm proud of that group. But I just, if I had to do it all over again, I would do it in a heartbeat. And I knew the gravity of what we were trying. Like, I remember waking up on this day and my chest was like really heavy and I was very stressed out. Because I felt the weight of the responsibility I had, and I knew, like, this man was putting a large amount of trust in me in a very scary transition in his life, even though he wasn't vocalizing that it was a scary transition. We all know the reality. To go from being, like, the most popular Republican governor in America to running as an independent for the United States Senate, none of us had any idea what that would look like. And even knowing now how it ended up, I would do it all over again in a heartbeat.
And I so wish Kendrick Meek had dropped out, had lived up to
his promise.
Promise to drop out. All right, so let's think about this summer having a little Crisp reunion retrospective.
You want to know what, like, a funny coincidence is? Speaking of Crisp reunion, Danny Kanter,
yeah,
who came back for our wedding,
for the NBA, right?
I don't remember. All I know is he now is a dad and he has a little girl and his daughter was born on October 5th.
Oh, that is magical.
So, like, what are the odds that, like, 2 people from that teeny tiny campaign 5 years apart have children born on the exact same day? It's pretty
That's
neat.
Amazing. Shout out to Danny Kanter. I think we can skip housekeeping this week.
Yeah,
right?
We've already covered it throughout the course, so that's fine.
All right. Give me your hot take for
It's
this
not,
week.
Yeah, and it's not really a hot take per se this week. This week is Maternal Mental Health Awareness Week. And I think that mental health still needs to be, we all know mental health conversations just need to be at the forefront in this world, not just this country. But I don't think a lot of people realize how fragile maternal mental health is. And I think a lot of people, there's a stigma around it. They don't want to talk about it. So here's what I want to say. 2 years ago, I was living in a hell of anxiety. And I didn't know what it was. You didn't know how to help me. I didn't know what I was dealing with. All I knew was that I was afraid and that I wasn't as good of a mom or a wife. And it took another mom looking at me and saying, you're having a nervous breakdown. You're literally in the middle of an anxiety attack. Ella was at gymnastics. And I had no idea that that was what was plaguing me. And that mom saw me and she talked to me. And it changed the course of my life. It led me to get help. And other moms talked to me. And, like, one mom gave me her psychiatrist. And another mom just, like, talked about symptoms. And it just, you know, it was a terrible time. We've now come to figure out I just can't drink caffeine. That's how I manage my anxiety, is absolutely zero caffeine intake. But what I want to say is it's Maternal Mental Health Awareness Week. And we all should maybe take this week to look at the moms in our lives and just kind of do a check-in and make sure that they're feeling okay. Because it is a lot of it. Women, we bear the weight of the world as mothers. And we're so worried about this Instagram and Facebook persona that we present to the world that oftentimes we're afraid to admit when we need help or what we're feeling. So if you think you have a friend who's struggling, maybe you should reach out to them. And if you've suffered through some mental health issues, maybe you should share it with people, because maybe you having the courage to talk about your struggles will help them identify what's going on with them and get the help they need.
I remember that period, and I was so, it's like
I was lost to you for a little while.
It was on me because my fault there was I had just such a lack of tolerance for it too. Like I was just like, I don't understand. Why aren't you happier about this? Or, you know, and once things are talked about, it's like that feeling you get after a rain. Like you just are like, oh my God, everything is gonna be okay.
Yeah.
And that's literally if just reach out and talk to somebody.
It popped up in my Facebook memories today. Yeah. There was a post and I saw it in my face. I saw that I was like literally in the middle of an anxiety attack, like when this photo was being taken. And it kind of crushed me that it took so long to figure it out. And that, you know, it didn't take me years. It was like a couple of month period.
It was. Yeah. And also there were this wasn't externally driven.
No, you know, it was a hormonal chemical imbalance.
And people need it. Like,
I can identify, like, there is a day every month and I know that it might come on and I take steps now.
Yeah.
And there have been times where I've had to be medicated. I don't need medication now, which is a great blessing. It's literally eliminating all the caffeine. If I get so much as like a drop of caffeine, I can feel it start to come back. So
there's a great app that I brought up to you outside of the podcast, Huji. And I think that this is a trend. It takes real photos and it doesn't use the filters that that Instagram does. And I just feel, and I think that you're going to see this big movement away from these things where, listen, and I heard
Instagram walls are out, are on the way out.
They are. They're just, you know, it's because it isn't real life. And we're setting ourselves up for diminished expectations, much less what the rest of the world thinks about us. So I have totally, my hot take is like just as serious as yours. And so I really don't understand. I don't know if it's appropriate for us to be participating in Cinco de Mayo anymore.
You are not going to take away my margaritas and guacamole.
As we move to that, as people listen to that, I just think that this is pretty much the most odd holiday that we have left standing. Like we've clearly moving away from Columbus Day, and I get that. But, and I know that Cinco de Mayo isn't like an official like bank holiday, but
stop trying to go after the bottom line of Mexican restaurants everywhere.
We are just at our ugliest of ugly Americans when we are celebrating Cinco de Mayo, because it has literally nothing to do with Mexico. Mexican Independence Day. It is the worst of cultural appropriation. And I'm just surprised that it's still standing in this era. And people are, again, I can just hear, you know, there is a great book. I sent it to one of my friends called White. And it was the book that was being presented in New York when the white nationalists kind of broke it up during a reading this weekend. I'm a white male Christian. I get what's going on and I understand we're under attack and our way of life, whatever.
You have felt it at times.
I do feel it. I'm not diminishing it.
Okay.
I'm not diminishing it at all.
Just making sure we're all being honest here.
No. I totally like for you to have power means I have to give up some power. That is what for Kamala Harris to win means that a white male will not
has to lose.
But I don't have to be upset with that.
And no, you don't.
I can celebrate that. And so I know that some people who listen to us and who are my good friends are going to view like, oh, why are you taking Cinco de Mayo away from us?
Because next thing you're going to come after Taco Tuesday, just stop. That is a line too far.
On that note, thank you to Steve Shale and Dean Cannon for being on with us today. Again, this is He Said,
She Said.